Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so we've pretty much started our winter retreat, and we've had a couple days of group practice, full schedule, and just encourage everybody to put one's attention onto the formal practice, put attention onto just a simplicity of approaching the practice. There's a tendency in all of us to make things more complicated than is necessary. And oftentimes we end up tripping ourselves up in practice, so that just putting attention onto really applying oneself to the practice, walking, sitting, sense restraint, contentment, these are fundamentals of the practice. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to explore the theme of the in terms of the readings that I've asked people to prepare, and picking up the Thai forest tradition in order to explore the roots of the practice, and how it's practiced in the lineage that we belong to, the lineage that we take as our reference point. I think there's some distinctive flavors of the Thai forest tradition that, of course I'm biased and it attracts me. That's why I ended up living in Thailand for 23 years. There was a very strong affinity both to the Thai tradition, the kind of the Thai temperament as how they live the teachings, and of course to personally to Ajahn Chah. And certainly, when you say Thai forest tradition, it isn't as if it's monolithic homogeneous expression of Buddhist practice. It's definitely not, and to me, that's a strength as well. There's not a just by Thai temperament. There's not a there's not a strong sense of trying to force people into conformity, and it's very kind of human. I think that's one of the things that is I think was very attractive to me, still is. The very human nature of the expression, which of course is sometimes, especially for idealistic Westerners seeking a standard party line, sometimes is frustrating. I think there's a practicality in the expression of the teaching and the practice that I think is something important for us to learn and learn from. Of course, yesterday Ajahn Kurundamo gave a reading, and that was the reading of Ajahn Chah. Giving a talk to Westerners on the fundamentals of the practice, and I think some themes that are very typical, say, of Ajahn Chah and of the Thai forest tradition, really shone through, and that the sense of just the importance of practice and the setting aside of theory, of course, is a very strong theme. It's also important to recognize the context, in the sense that most of the monks that Ajahn Chah taught, when he emphasized the putting away of the books, are monks who tended to have a foundation in study already. They had a basic knowledge and understanding of the teachings, and then even within the culture, there's a fundamental understanding and a basis for faith and confidence in the teaching and the practice. So that, that's it's a rather different background than us, but still that sense of putting a substantial amount of attention and effort toward the practice. Remember Ajahn Chah one day saying, he said, took his little finger and said, "Yeah, you should study this much, but you should practice this much." taking the little finger compared to the whole arm, and that there's a because there is an effort on our part to, or an assumption that somehow if we had enough knowledge and we have enough information, then we get it all straight and we wouldn't have any doubts or confusion anymore. and everything would be just hunky-dory. But the actual clarity and confidence is much more, its source is much more in the practice. And sometimes it's painful to go through the what we feel like is slogging through the difficulties of obstacles in meditation, confusion and doubt, it's kind of, it's essential. It's kind of like trying to learn how to ride a bicycle or drive a car just by reading the books, and now you can watch YouTube videos but for all of the reading, the watching, the getting all the theories and taking notes and getting all the points down, you really don't get any proficiency until you do it and you continue to do it. So that is very similar to our practice. Ajahn Mahamon, who was one of the senior disciples of Ajahn Chah, and who was a seventh degree Pali scholar, which there's only 9 degrees, and it's very difficult to get that. Those last 2 degrees are very hard. When he went to explore and to explore the possibilities of this teacher he kept hearing about, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah gave him the image of he said, and he addressed him very respectfully, Tan Maha, said, you've got all this paper, you've got all your knowledge comes from paper, and you did your tests and you wrote that on paper, and your degrees, and you've got put that up on your wall, or you keep it somewhere on your desk, and you got this verification of your knowledge on paper. And he said, but it's kind of like having pictures of horses, and you can have all these pictures of horses pasted up all over the place, but all they are paper horses, and they can't actually get you anywhere. Even if you had one old horse, it could still get you further than all those paper horses you got. So that sense of the necessity of putting things into practice and emphasizing that practice and being willing to be patient with the practice. And I think that's another flavor that again is typical of forest tradition in particular, and Ajahn Chah in particular, the emphasis on patience, the Buddha's path is actually not, the Buddha didn't design it to make it comfortable and pleasurable and easy. He recognized that the if we're really intent on freeing ourselves from suffering, we're going to have to be willing to go against the stream of our desires, our attachments, our habits, our conditioning. And without going against that, without being patient enough to stick with the kind of difficulty and friction that comes up when we thwart our preferences, not bother to follow all of our impulses and likes and dislikes, then it's going to be uncomfortable. And it doesn't when you look at the Buddha's teachings, and whether it's for a monastic or for a layperson, there's nothing that extreme, or there's nothing that seemingly difficult. But when you really do it, be willing to challenge those habits and the preferences of our desire systems, it brings up a lot. It's really interesting. When I was in Thailand and I went to visit a monastery there, and one of the monks is somebody who used to come here as a layperson, Thai person, a lot of interest, a lot of enthusiasm and dedication to practice, and had done his graduate work and got his PhD from Berkeley, and had finished up got his degree, and he was really focused. He was going back and taking ordination, which he did. And shortly before the rains retreat. And of course, I saw him in December, so that's about 6 months in the robes. And I saw him, and I didn't quite recognize him because he was so thin. Anyway, I said, you lost a lot of weight. Oh, yeah. And I said, what's up? You having any kind of difficulty? Oh, yeah, I've had lots of difficulties. And what's difficult about it? And he said, everything's difficult, Ajahn. So, oh, you didn't think that when you thought you wanted ordained. He said, oh, I had no idea it was going to be this difficult. That was really sweet. So I had a good chance to chat and talk and encourage him, and just that increased appreciation for when the path is practiced, it necessarily thwarts our desire systems, our preferences, our habits of mind. And that challenges us. And that takes patience to be willing to investigate, to watch, to understand more clearly how that works, so that we can actually relinquish and let go. And that, so that quality of patience is is an integral part of the training. That's part and parcel of the Thai forest tradition, and then that emphasis, I think, also part of the Thai forest tradition is where I think those two things sort of go together well in terms of patience and the emphasis on practice and practicality. That's where there's a lot of refinement that's developed in the, and this particularly for the monastics, but it's a great example for the lay community, and you see that in the lay community of those who draw close to the forest monasteries. There's a strong training in comportment and demeanor and the interactions that we have, ways of looking out for each other, taking on duties and responsibilities, acts of service, that one develops a strong sense of mindfulness and presence. And one sees that in well-trained monastics. I remember going to, I think it was the first time I went down to Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, and and met with there's a teacher, a woman there who was a Dhamma teacher and she was a former university professor, very committed, very savvy, and both very learned as well as very well practiced. But I remember her saying just how she spent quite a bit of time with Ajahn Chah's monasteries, before Ajahn Chah became ill. And she said it was a very simple statement and very, say, uncontrived in the sense that she said, "Oh, it's just so nice to see monks from Ajahn Chah come, because you can almost tell as soon as they walk in that they come from Ajahn Chah's monastery. They're just well trained and have a real sense of composure." And that, you know, a part of that is not contrived or forcing oneself to come into some role, but it's like when you live in a way where you're really paying attention to the little things of how you relate to each other, how you help each other, how you give service and look after each other, there's a mindfulness and a clarity and a selflessness that is carried through. And, you know, again, that's not something you learn from a book. It's not something that you get from a scripture even. This is how it's lived. So learning how to live the teachings, learning how to live the training. So that sense of patience and practice and a humility. And that's like with Ajahn Chah, I remember him receiving one of the senior monks from the say ecclesiastical hierarchy, and you know, this was fairly early. I was a fairly young monk, and it was still a time when Ajahn Chah was only just getting recognized. In general, he had been either vilified or treated with grave suspicion about his him as a monk, as a teacher. He endured a lot of criticism. And but this monk comes from the ecclesiastical hierarchy, and he just was immediately very gracious, got down from his own seat, was very attentive to the senior monk, and I don't know what the background was, but just to see him being so solicitous and genuinely caring was very beautiful. And certainly when, say, we as Westerners went to live at Wat Nanachat, then Ban Bung Wai, the Bung Wai village, has a village monastery, and the head monk of the little district, Tambon, he was seat of authority, and he was Ajahn Chah's preceptor. And he hated Ajahn Chah. He just never missed up an opportunity to criticize or cast aspersions. But when we went to live there, then Ajahn Chah tasked us and said, "He's my preceptor. Please go every week and do the duties of preceptor to him." In the sense that I'm getting older now, I'm far away, I can't do those duties. Please go help clean up the monastery, help look after him. And when we first showed up, this old grumpy monk was just really confused because he's invested a lot of energy in being nasty to Ajahn Chah. And then Ajahn Chah sent his... Ajahn Chah never really... he wasn't as if he'd kept up some kind of running conflict with him. It was sort of... Ajahn Chah just sort of avoided the any kind of conflict. So then he... So we would show up and help out, and at first he was against us even having the monastery there. He didn't want us nearby, but then he kind of warmed up to us, and in the end, it sort of, as he got older and sicker, we were both the only people that came and helped him out when he was ill. And he was incredibly grateful. And then when he passed away, then I went with Ajahn Chah to the funeral ceremony. And I mean, that was a whole other experience. But it was it was sort of boxing matches and movies, and it's a whole other thing. but Ajahn Chah made the point of going over and being there. That was his preceptor. So that he did the right thing. And you know, it'd be easy to get all full of righteous indignation and say, well, he doesn't practice and he doesn't do, and he's criticized me, and why should I? And you know, and it would be very reasonable. But Ajahn Chah would always take the what's a better way of training? What's a better thing to rise up to? You know, that takes patience, and it takes a willingness to not just follow one's impulse or one's mood at the time. And I'm sure that Ajahn Chah had a variety of feelings around that. But, you know, he made a point of, okay, what's the right thing as a monk? What's the right thing as a practitioner of Dhamma? What did the Buddha actually recommend? And that takes a patience to a willingness to go against the stream of our habits. So these elements of practice, patience, these are integral aspects of a certain flavor, the practicality of it, kind of the hands-on quality of the practice. Not just a formal reading and memorizing of scripture, or even a formal following of some sort of method, but a willingness to live the Dhamma. Right, to really be the Dhamma. And this is what I remember Ajahn Chah sort of saying when there was a period where he'd say, oh, you know, come up many, many times over and over and say, you know, it's like, you know, first you have to know the Dhamma so that the actual, you know, having some kind of knowledge of the teachings of the practice. And then you have to see the Dhamma, so you have to put it into practice so that you have an experiential seeing. And he said, then you have to be the Dhamma, so that when you really live it and steep yourself in it, and you know, not separate yourself from the Dhamma, so that learning how to be the Dhamma. These are aspects of our training, and certainly over these next 3 months, we really want people to explore and you know, reflect and of course put it into practice. I think something else that just in terms of when, you know, thinking of the Thai forest, the readings that we're doing, exploring the Thai forest tradition, and this aspect of its, say, humanness. It's a living tradition that we're a part of. Something today that happened reminds me of just how much this is a part, that we are a part of a living tradition. So the Mukh was here, and when she grew up, her parents would take her. She grew up in Ubon. When she grew up, she would go to Wat Bapong, and Ajahn Chah was a teacher for her parents and for her, which this I knew. Then she was just talking today and sort of saying, and I can't remember. Oh, I know how it came up, about the they were asking about the Lumpur Thun monastery behind us. What was happening? What was going on there? What kind of presence was there? And then I said, "Well, there." I'm saying, "Well," and Gary asked, "Well, you know, who was his teacher? Was he a Mahanikaya or Dhammayut?" And I said, "Well, he's a, you know, Dhammayut monk who was a student of Lumpur Khao." And Merck said, "Well, Lumpur Khao was my great uncle." as his mom's uncle, and this sense that, you know, we're part of a living tradition. These are people that are they're human beings. And said, I met him when I was you know, he lived up in Udon, which was quite a ways away, but we went, you know, we went up and visited him sometimes, he was really gracious and warm, and he remembered all of the, you know, all the villages around and the various relatives they had in common and whatnot. And Lumpur Khao, this Mukh's great uncle, and, you know, sort of great master who we actually have relics of up in there behind the Buddha image on the ordination platform, and his, they're the most beautiful relics, because they're like amethyst. All of his relics came out in this wonderful kind of a crystal, purpley amethyst sort of color, and very beautiful. But so these are human beings, and they, you know, they have relatives, and they have relationships with the people around them, and that, like when Ajahn Chah went back to establish Wat Bapong, it was, so what was that? That was 1977. When the BBC came and did the television program, The Mindful Way, and they wanted to film us going on alms round and so they wanted it in Bangor, Ajahn Chah's home village. And so Ajahn Chah probably, you know, that's, when did he start Wat Bapong? early 1950s? 54. And Ajahn Chah sort of, remember him sort of saying, that'll be interesting. I haven't been to alms round in Bangor since I started the monastery. It was like, because he said, he's going back to his home village to establish a monastery, and he didn't want to stir up his mind with memories of either friends, relatives, images of where he grew up, and all of those things that had the association. And he would go alms round. He'd always went alms round kind of on the other side of Wat Bapong. There are many villages around Wat Bapong. He was always go off on the other side. And Bangor was about 3 kilometers, 3 kilometers out the front of the monastery. And so he just wouldn't go there. He kept that as a practice, in the sense of, okay, this is, as a human being, you carry all these associations and images and habits, and those are things to be worked with, and they're things to be very cautious of. So you don't want to be, and he was obviously meet some of the people, but it was sort of on his turf, he really kept a distance so that he wasn't drawn back into old ways of doing things, old ways of perceiving either himself or others. And there's a humanness to that, the recognition, as human beings, we're complicated creatures. And do we really want to be feeding the things that keep us stuck in different ways, or keep us following habits that aren't really very conducive to freedom from suffering? And, finding very simple ways of doing that. So that, that kind of commitment and a practicality, I think a very it's a good example for us. So these are just sort of, there's all these different sort of flavors and facets of the Thai Forest tradition that are worth exploring, reflecting on, but in particular, informing our own practice. What do we do to support our own aspiration for freedom from suffering? What do we do to undermine the habits and biases that we have? How do we recognize more clearly when those come up? And again, that's where the practice is so important. Obviously we make mistakes. But the willingness to learn from those mistakes, remember Ajahn Chah having one particular monk who was he was fairly senior, and he was always doing things that would upset others and just would create problems, and Ajahn Chah, I mean, he would reprimand him, he would encourage him, but he kept, people would you know, get indignant and sort of, you know, throw him out, get rid of him. And Ajahn Chah would sort of say, you know, he still has faith. Give him a chance. You know, and he's still a monk today. He's still a monk in our tradition. And he's in his, as he's much older, and he seems to be a lot more accepted and respected within the whole community, all the communities. And it's just, yeah, sometimes it takes time, but we have to be willing to, for ourselves to learn from our mistakes, but also to be patient with ourselves and patient with each other. You know, those are qualities, I think, that the tradition tends to point to and encourage. And of course, there's, you know, when the actual emphasis that Ajahn Chah put on, when you're not involved in group practice, don't waste time socializing, don't waste time getting caught up in external things. Put your emphasis on the internal investigation, internal training, walking meditation, sitting meditation. You know, it's the knowledge and understanding and relinquishment come from that continued willingness to put forth effort and to be diligent. And what Ajahn Chah would say, that continuity of practice, having that diligence and continuity in the practice, the application of the practice. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Sadhu.